Welcome to the Optimal Body Podcast. I'm Doc Jen.
And I'm Dr. Dom, and we are doctors of physical therapy, bringing you the body tips and physical therapy pearls of wisdom to help you begin to understand your body, relieve your pains and restrictions, and answer your questions.
Along with expert guests, our goal of the Optimal Body Podcast is really to help you discover what optimal means within your own body. Let's dive in.
Our guest today is Dr. Robert Whitfield, who's a board-certified plastic surgeon and founder of the SHARP Method, a structured biologic recovery system integrating surgery, genetics, detoxification, mitochondrial optimization, and regenerative medicine. He is nationally recognized for his work in breast implant illness and has published the largest series of PCR-tested explant capsules demonstrating bacterial contamination in nearly 29% of cases. He has performed thousands of explant surgeries and over 1,000 autologous fat transfer procedures. Dr. Whitfield is a pioneer in simultaneous explant surgery with fat transfer, combining surgical precision with regenerative aesthetics to restore natural volume without synthetic materials. Now, Dr. Whitfield truly is a pioneer in this industry and has a very unique and insightful experience with so much information to share. So let's get into it. Dr. Rob, thanks so much for taking some time to chat with us today. Really about a topic that we haven't interviewed anybody about, which is breast implants, breast implant removal. Yeah, just appreciate your time being here.
Oh, thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
So what originally led you into so heavily focusing on breast implant illness and biologic recovery?
So my background for all the listeners, this will be in 2026, 30 years after I, oh my God, that's a long time, after I finished medical school, and today is the 18th. So I would have graduated yesterday, 30 years ago. And yesterday was my daughter's bachelorette, which is like a little ceremony they have here at a church we attend for all sorts of faiths, which was great. So my whole programming through training and then ultimately in practice was around cancer reconstruction. So I spent 8 years of surgery, plastic surgery, and another ninth year just focused on reconstructive microsurgery for basically cancer care. So I took care of patients with sarcomas, which are really rare tumors of bone, muscle, and fat and tendon. You would rarely know anybody who had a sarcoma. Then I took care of head and neck cancer patients. So cancers of like the jawbone or the tongue, the throat, less common, but still you would run into those. Then I took care of folks who were in accidents. So I was basically in the home of Harley Davidson in Milwaukee. So I would take care of tons of people once the kind of snow melted and the bikes could come out. They were not really the problem, but you would take care of them because the people couldn't see them and they would just hit them, you know, not obviously on purpose, but that would happen in the summertime at such a high rate. I'd never seen anything like this because in the upper Midwest, it's so cold for so long. And then finally, when the snow melts enough for people to go out and ride, they would ride. And then finally, the thing that I would do the most, unfortunately, was breast cancer reconstruction, because that's a very prevalent cancer, 1 in 8 women. And then by virtue of having taken care of patients with mastectomy reconstruction, that's basically how I got involved in this. So I did a surgery called the deep flap reconstruction, and I'll try to condense it this way. So anything that is your own tissue will not get rejected. That makes sense, yeah. Right? So the first organ transplant was done between genetically identical twins by Dr. Joseph Murray, who happened to be a plastic surgeon, in the 60s. And so it worked because you didn't need drugs. All you needed to do was execute the steps. And surgically, he executed all the steps between two genetically identical twins. And so the twin who received the kidney started to recover. And that started what we call organ transplantation. Yeah. So the next step was to do a non-identical twin. And so that needed immunosuppressive help, because anything that's not completely identical, like Siamese twins are genetically identical, you would need some form of immunosuppression. Otherwise, you would respond, attack it, and reject it.
Yeah.
So that was the next step. And the final step is cadaver. So me giving a kidney to one of y'all. So you would obviously need to take medicine to block the response from taking an organ from someone who is not genetically identical. And the next step is a non-identical twin or a living related donor, which some in your family would, you know, get tested and they would have more of an HLA match is what it's called. So all that being said is I performed autologous reconstruction using tissue from someone's own body. So I would take the tissue that is discarded into the tummy tuck, like the lower abdominal tissue, and make what's called the DIEP free flip. So I would take the skin and fat, leave it connected to the blood vessels, kind of like an extension cord of sorts, and then hook it up underneath the breastbone to the internal mammary artery and vein, just like the cardiac surgeons used to revascularize the heart back when they did that before stents. So ultimately, that's what I did. Now, when you take care of anybody having a mastectomy and you do that operation that I just said, typically you would have to do a secondary procedure to help contour that once the patient had recovered, because although you could recreate a breast mound, it would not have the same aesthetic, just like it wouldn't have the same aesthetic if you had done a implant-based reconstruction. If that makes sense, right? So there's going to be limitations always. So I try to explain it this way. So for, you know, the first 15 years of my career after training, I would do 100 to 150 fat transfers to contour those DIP free flap reconstructions, which were done for mastectomies with your own tissue. And then I would also have to do contouring procedures for patients who had a tissue expander and then an implant-based reconstruction. So I didn't do as many implant-based reconstructions because technically, this sounds weird, I didn't have enough time. The other operation took a lot of time, and that's what I was best at, trained at. And so that's where referrals would come to me more. Like, think of it in this country, which has, our country's huge, right? We have all this land. We have 350 million people. Once you get out of a place with a million people, it's really hard to find someone like me, because you need a certain amount of training, but you need a lot of support, right? So if you took me and put me in a smaller place, could I do it? Well, technically, yes, I can do it, but I need an operating room microscope. I need the technicians in the operating room, the surgical technicians to help. I need the nursing staff to run in the OR. I need the anesthesia staff and support. We need the operating room support, all the instrumentation, plus you need aftercare. So you need the nursing staff to be able to care for them afterward, recognize if there's a problem, let me know, come back if need be, you know, go back and reoperate on somebody. It's a lot of support, right? Versus an implant-based reconstruction where just think of in the community hospital setting, so like a smaller hospital setting, a diagnosis is made and they'll say, okay, this is the situation, and if the patient needed a mastectomy, here would be the options. Now, the patient's explained, you know, probably a number of options from the breast surgeon. And then if they could meet with a plastic surgeon, the plastic surgeon would explain like the options. Now, if they wanted to stay in their community, in a community-based setting, and not travel or anything, the plastic surgeons would be able to certainly do a implant-based reconstruction, because you don't need all that technical support, all that nursing support, all that higher end, you know, training and support, if you want to think of it like that. So that's the most common form of breast reconstruction in the entire world, because that's the most accessible, if that makes right. sense.
Yeah.
Yeah, totally. Definitely.
So I used to get, you know, being the new guy, right, with all the fancy training and all the things, they would send me all the like not so great cases or cases that would self-refer. And I had this patient in 2006, so I had been in practice like probably less than a year, and I had a patient come And she kept having what was called red breast syndrome, which is a made-up term. Basically, the patient was having a histamine release or like a mast cell activation type release before it was a thing. And she came to me and she's like, you know, Dr. Whitfield, I don't really like the reconstruction with the implants. It doesn't feel good. It hurts. It's kind of tight. She felt like she had like a little band on her chest. She had trouble taking a deep breath. And I said, well, those are all really mechanical symptoms. And then she said, sometimes I get this kind of redness and they think I have an infection. They'll put me in the hospital and they give me antibiotics. And she was like completely over that whole process. Didn't want to do that anymore. And I said, well, I have a few thoughts. Okay. So if I take all the implant-based material out, the scar tissue, everything, and it's just your tissue, and I do this reconstruction with your own tissue from your abdomen, then if in fact it has anything to do with the device and a reaction from it, that'll stop, right? Because I will have done a genetically identical reconstruction, basically, an autologous reconstruction is what we call it, kind of like the kidney transplant. That's how I think of it, to be fair. And I did that for this patient. And afterwards, she had no more issues with what was called the red breast syndrome or any of that, because you can't react to your own tissue, right? It's genetically identical.
Yeah.
And if you had an infection or another problem, then that would lend itself to a more easy treatment, if you want to think of it. I try to keep everything super simple. So if I'm not making sense, just stop me. So like moving forward throughout my years of my career, I was taking care of this problem without knowing I was taking care of the problem. Does that make sense?
Right. Yeah.
And then in 2016, I had a breast cancer patient that had a reconstruction done elsewhere in the country who retired in Austin, Texas, where I practice. And she said, I want to go flat. I don't want a reconstruction anymore. And I was like, all right, no problem. So, we did her case in a hospital, and I want to say she had a cardiac condition. The cardiologist wanted her monitored overnight. And so I did the case, and I always did the case the same way from the time I started practice to the time, you know, I finished doing oncologic reconstruction, we'll say in 2019. I take all the scar tissue out. We'd send cultures, send everything to pathology, and pathology is to rule out recurrent cancer. You always do that. You send scars or any of that tissue to make sure there's not a new problem with cancer for the patient. You just want to know that. And then two, you send things for what's called culture insensitivity. So that's to look for bacteria, fungus, and mycobacteria. And so I sent that off, and her pathology came back. She had no cancer, obviously. Super important. My sister passed away from breast cancer, and we always want to make sure that for long-term health, we look at that. But what was curious in her is it came back, she had an E. coli infection. And so I was like, it really like irked me, right? So I was like, how did I miss an E. coli infection? How did we all miss an E. coli infection? Because, you know, this, I'm like one provider in I'm a Kodak moment in her life. Of providers. But this had been missed for I don't know how long. And then I went back through all the, you know, labs we had and all the tests or studies or anything. You know, I was just trying to figure out, like, how did I miss this? And there was no indication on any of the standard blood labs, which is unfortunate. So anyway, long story short is, her one symptom was fatigue. And so if I look back at all the people, what's the most common symptom? You're like, oh, what's the most common symptom of this breast implant illness problem? It's always fatigue. And so she had that. And so hers happened to be from a documented infection. And so I treated it. And, you know, what do you know? Like, all of her fatigue went away, which, okay. So, okay, she had an untreated infection. So why do you get that? So for everybody listening, there's three ways to get an infection in this situation as it pertains to a medical device. You can contaminate the device when the staff in the operating room opens the packaging that's holding the device. Now, everything is double packaged. if there's a violation of the outer package, they immediately don't give you that implant because they think there's a problem. So everything's double packaged. The next opportunity is you give it to the surgeon and somehow the surgeon contaminates it on placement. So they touch the skin, they break technique, there's some problem. Now, those first two ways to get that are really, really low incidents, right? That's typically not going to happen. There's like so many precautions taken for those first two instances. That's super low in our world. We're very fortunate. We're in the United States. We have extremely high standards, and how we approach things in the operating rooms are very specific to avoid those first two types of problems. Now, the third is what I like to call a four-letter word we refer to as life. Things that happen throughout your life, right? You get exposed to things, you get colds, infections, cuts on your skin, abrasions, whatever the thing is. You may get a urinary tract infection, a chest infection, a gut infection, whatever. That's how you get this problem. So the problem is you get bacteria in your blood, and that's what we refer to as bacteremia. Now, if you don't have a device, your body will surveil all this stuff, and you may get sick. But you can treat that and there won't be a quote unquote consequence like what I'm going to talk about next. So when bacteria is going through your circulation, it can attach to a device, hip, knee, breast, dental implant, cardiac implant, neurologic implant, because those things are not your tissue. We already had the big talk earlier about your tissue and how we can move it around and revascularize it. So you can't surveil that. Our immune system is not geared up to surveil that, but it'll react to it because it'll recognize it as foreign. So it already recognizes the device as foreign, but when bacteria attach to it and form like these little colonies, we refer to that as biofilm. Think of like plaque on your teeth as the original biofilm. And so that interaction between the bacteria and now the tissue, we'll say in the breast, specifically the fatty acid in the breast called oleic acid, can cause an oxidative reaction. Now, oxidative is not good. We always want to have more reduced versus oxidative. Oxidative is more work, more stress. That reaction leads to a product called oxylipentinum, which has been measured in the laboratory setting and associated with increased symptoms in patients with breast implant illness. And that was published by Dr. Mathoon Sina in the first quarter of 2024. So that's a real entity, cause and effect. And then you're going to be like, well, how often does that happen? So I published a big paper in Q3, because I'm slow, in 2024 of 694 consecutive scar tissue specimens that we looked at after explant. And 29% of them have bacteria. The two most common are Staph epidermidis and Cutibacterium acnes, which are the most common that produce biofilm. So we try to like be really, I think, practical about this. Any device can become infected. It doesn't matter if it's hip, knee, breast, dental, cardiac, neurologic, any implant can get infected. So that's, everybody knows that. And in this case, the reaction that happens and creates this biomarker. Now, everybody asks me, can you test for oxylipentinum? No, that was done in a research environment. You can't go to Quest or LabCorp with a requisition form and get that test. So then people ask me, well, how do you know what's going on? Like, okay. So a couple things I say is you can't pick your parents, or you can't outrun a bad diet. So if you have poor detox genes you inherited from your parents, it doesn't mean you're cooked. It just means like we have to think about and help you maybe slightly different ways. And so the vitamin D pathway, the methylation pathway, everybody's heard of MTHFR. Everybody's like, it's become like ubiquitous now when you talk about that. Everybody knows about that gene. Then the antioxidant pathway. Now, we were just talking about oxidative stress. So if we have too much oxidative stress, we build up something called O3, which is a free radical. That puts a lot of stress on us from a cellular standpoint. So if we have a poor pathway that deals with that, we have more problems with that. And the final one is the glucuronidation pathway. And I'll say like these two genes, GSST and GSTP1, are important. Everybody may or may not understand the antioxidant glutathione, but that's really important in that pathway. So if we have limitations in those pathways of vitamin D metabolism and methylation and glucuronidation and our antioxidant system, all we need is like a dash of problems with, in her case, estrogen metabolism. And now you have the avatar to have the most problems with chronic inflammation that I see. Now, people ask me, can you just live in harmony with your implants? Well, if you pick your parents right, if you lead a non-toxic lifestyle and eat all the right things and do all the right things, then yeah, sure.
So do you think that, you know, everyone who has an implant is basically, you know, should be thinking about explant in these different ways? Because I think it's hard to know there's, you know, fatigue. It's so hard to know where that's really coming from. Is that really from my implants? Is it the fact that I have young kids and I'm not sleeping? Or, you know, like there's so many other factors that play a role into our lifestyle that could be leading to these common symptoms that happen. So should everyone be thinking about a different method and about explant?
Oh, you said the keyword method. So I wrote this book called The Sharp Method. And the methodology is really to answer the question you're asking. So you're asking, like, how do we bridge basically understanding Western medicine with functional medicine in this setting? And so the short answer is, until you get the oxylapin 10-home biomarker test commercially available, it's only going to make it a little bit more challenging. So we look at genetics to look at those pathways. So that's a saliva test, non-invasive, you know, easy to do. And so we'll just say, in my patients that have the most symptoms, 83% of them have problems in those four pathways. So it's a common kind of theme. You don't detox well, right? So then what's the other situation? Well, if you don't detox well and you get exposed to lots of stuff, mold, environmental chemicals, heavy metals, that's going to create more than your body can handle. And everybody's heard of the concept of, well, when the bucket gets full, it runs over, or the sink is full, or the bathtub fills up and it runs over. So that's when you get more symptomatic. And I think your question really just is about balance. Like, how do you balance all that out? And so a lot of things are very, very simple to me. Sleep is what I prioritize in terms of things you can do starting today when you listen to the show that we're doing right now. What can you do, try to do better? And there was a paper published that my friend put on LinkedIn, and it shows that if you don't eat close to bedtime, your recovery is better. Well, obviously that makes a lot of sense. So we tell patients, stop eating about 3 hours before bed and stop drinking about 2 hours before bed. Now, I try to encourage people to get off their phones and tablets and all the junk about an hour before bed so they can have better sleep hygiene. But all the things that happen that are important really happen at night. Recovery is at night. It's not during the day. It's not when you're awake. You're going to rebuild and restore and repair at night when you're asleep. So it's super important to get sleep hygiene. People who, and I have a lot of clients, right, predominantly female clients, who get up in the middle of the night to pee. And always I'm like, why are you doing that? You're not an old guy with a prostate. That doesn't make any sense. So usually that's from hydrating too close to bedtime. So you got to back off like when you're taking in fluid last, and then you got to empty your bladder before you go to bed. That's basically it. Now you can have dysregulated cortisol waking you up at the wrong times. That's a different problem. But you can consciously stop taking in fluid at a certain time. Nobody's going to die. You'll be fine. The other things are always like, what are the quality of the things you're putting in your body and on your body? Like, those are things you can help control now. They don't require, I would say, a lot of extra financial resources, but they do require you paying attention to what you're doing and looking at things more critically. And, you know, maybe like getting rid of some things that maybe we know were not great, you know, for us, but we still do it kind of anyway. Like, maybe it's, you know, in Texas, it's like sweet tea with barbecue, right? So that's a common thing here. Gotta have your sweet tea. It's not really great for you. right? That's not a, that's, I mean, the barbecue is already tough because it can be a little bit, not that the barbecue in general is bad. It's just everything that goes along with the barbecue can be a little bit more challenging.
So you got to have that mac and cheese and that fried okra.
Yeah, the sides, right? Right. So I think as long as we're all on the same page, like you can do a lot without spending a lot to help yourself in the beginning. So, you know, if you can source, we'll just say some filtered water and not drink it out of plastic, that would be a great start. So use glass or stainless. Try to pay attention to what you're eating. And then people, like, I'll tell them to be gluten-free, dairy-free, and try to avoid seed oils. And they're like, well, I can't eat anything. Well, there's a lot of things like animal proteins, plant proteins, fruits and vegetables that don't belong in any of those other categories I just said. So you'll be just fine. You won't die. And, you know, the air quality is probably the most underappreciated thing. I live in Austin. We have a ton of trouble with cedar, oak, and mold here. Like, and I get a lot of hay fever or kind of allergy symptoms. So the first, if I had to invest in something, would be make sure I don't have sleep apnea because I want to protect my brain health. So if you snore or if women wake up having problems with gasping, then you really should get a sleep apnea test. Obstructive sleep apnea is a huge driver of Alzheimer's. So if I had one test to implore anybody listening to, and I don't get any money from them, is a sleep apnea test, whether you do it through insurance or the sleep lab, or you do, there's a company called ResMed, which I don't get any money from, and they'll send you one to do. Huh. So that's super important for just your brain. So I have two kids. I want to be, you know, able to hopefully see their see my grandkids. Like, I want to be a with it at that point. But then I would invest in a high quality air filter, something like Jasper, Swiss IQ Air, because they have high enough ratings to filter the air, including mold spores, out of the air, which is probably, to me, one of the big drivers of problems that I see. Just untreated mold from leaks in homes, older homes with the, you know, whatever, HVAC problems or roof leak, sink leak, shower leak, whatever the thing is, that's a really, I know we probably said a fair amount there, but those are how I'd prioritize those. And I didn't mention a supplement really, and I didn't mention anything else.
Yeah. And I appreciate that a lot of what you talk about, understandably, everyone will have some sort of excuse or reason why it's difficult. I mean, we've got our two young kids, 1-year-old, 3-year-old, and you talk about sleep hygiene and improving our sleep and we roll our eyes, but you bring up good points about not eating 3 hours before bed, not drinking water 2 hours before bed, both things that I currently do that I probably shouldn't do if I want to control the things that I can control right now. And I think that there's always that low-hanging fruit that people can, you know, pick on. As far as symptoms go, I mean, you bring up fatigue, you had brought up the red breast, you know, syndrome that woman was coming in reporting. And I kind of want to drill down on this 29, you said 29% of samples that you sent in for that paper that you did tested positive for some sort of bacteria, correct?
Mm-hmm.
What are other symptoms in general that people will experience? And it's not exclusive to people who are testing positive for bacteria, correct? Like, all sorts of people who have implants, regardless of the presence of bacteria,
can have symptoms. Yeah, we'll do the symptoms and then we'll just go through the rest so it makes more sense. So I always say, like, if you didn't want me to try to figure out the answer to this problem, you should not have asked me the question. So in 2019, they put me on a task force to help answer these questions when I was president-elect of a research foundation. And I gave some FDA testimony that we would try to figure out by funding studies, like, what is and what's going on. And so we did that. I would not say that we've completely solved, you know, the puzzle, but the top symptoms are always going to be, like you said, initially, like I said, fatigue. So once again, that's kind of a catch-all for lots of things. And the one that got me initially that was confusing to me was brain fog. Because I really didn't understand what the hell brain fog was. And I had to have it explained to me. I kept asking questions because I'm curious. I'm like, what does brain fog mean to you? Because it's going to mean something different to each person. And finally, I arrived at it just means short-term memory loss, basically. So you can't remember where you put your keys, or you can't remember kids' names, or you can't remember you left the groceries in the car, and you just wander off from the house. Like, probably all stuff we've done, but it's just more frequent. And it gets blamed for, like you said, you got young kids, or you're busy, or you're tired, or... You know, I have people in their 30s tell me they've been told they're going through menopause, which is complete bullshit. All sorts of odd things, right? And so you can have that and muscle and joint pain and shortness of breath and chest tenderness and tightness and like all sorts of gut issues, like bloating, swelling, constipation, diarrhea, cramping, like all those things. Recurrent UTIs, bladder spasms, skin rashes, total body acne, eczema. Losing your hair, you know, I mean, if you can name some bizarre symptom, I've probably been, you know, told that, and those are kind of the laundry list of the top ones, but those align with a lot of things. So it's super confusing.
It is very confusing.
And I really don't envy folks, whether they're a surgeon or a functional practitioner, a naturopath, a chiro, trying to figure this out, because it doesn't make a lot of sense in a like standard way. Like, I don't listen to people to try to make a diagnosis about this as a like a problem. Most people, by the time they get to me, have stalked me for several years and listened to shows I've done or my show or read my book or whatever, because nobody really wants to come visit me in Austin, Texas and have this procedure done, because it's not, brings up a lot of trauma, things that led them to get something that now no longer aligns with them, or they didn't want after a certain period of time, or whatever the case may be. There's a lot of issues that it brings up. And I try to get people to work on that before they ever get to us, because my team and I are not psychiatrists, we're not psychologists, we're not mental health providers. And this becomes a big issue with patients and a big release of negative energy that can be given to us. So I try to have and give them a lot of space. And my team is super supportive. My nurse practitioner I've operated on, my functional detox team lead I've operated on, and another member of that team. And so everybody like who's taking care of patients is super supportive. Many have had the procedure, so they're acutely aware of all the ups and downs and ebbs and flows of what's going to happen. That doesn't give anybody license to treat people poorly. You know, there's a bunch of keyboard warriors out there that like to go on and say whatever it is they want to say about us. You can talk about me all day long, but don't ever say anything about my team. My team is super committed 100% to take care of patients, as I always have been. And I'm used to getting grief, but don't ever criticize the team. They work extremely hard. They're very dedicated to helping the patients. So I just want everybody to get better. And the reason the program is set up the way it is think of like a bell curve. You don't want a bunch of people to the right. You want everybody recovering and doing well as soon as possible. So you're really trying to push everything over. Like, you just want to move it completely. And that's our goal, is to take a big cortisol surge. So you think of the bell curve, like the top of it is the cortisol surge. And you want to shorten that as much as possible. And the way you shorten something is not by reacting to a problem after it happens. It's by diligently preparing what we just told you earlier. Concentrate on your sleep hygiene. Pay attention to your nutrition. Pay attention to everything you put in and on your body, because clearly your body's not happy if you're experiencing these symptoms. And you can have all these same symptoms and not have breast implants.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what? That's just chronic inflammation. So I tell everybody the same way, the same. I'm a broken record. Like, I consider this to be a chronic inflammatory process, of which a medical device, in this case, a breast implant, is playing a role. And that is it.
And do you see significant improvement in people especially when they follow the protocol that you lay out prior to explant. But do you see a significant impact in the symptoms that people are experiencing after the explant surgery?
Yeah, I think the short answer is yes, as it pertains to when you get started and how, you know, everybody should understand that there is no, and there should not be this expectation of rainbows and unicorns, because that's not the case. Like, the cases that are uniquely positioned to have that response are those that are infected, like I mentioned earlier. Right. Somebody may have been dealing with a rupture or a leak, or Lauren, a client of mine, she was degrading her implant by overuse of a barrel sauna, using it up to hour and a half at a time, multiple times a week at 200 degrees Fahrenheit. So she was causing leaching out of the device into her body, which, you know, we said on her show, which is incorrect. She had always joked with me, "Oh, Dr. Rafael, I'm just melting my implant." And I'm like, "Yeah, I'm basically." And we said that on her show. And of course, some plastic surgeon called and got pissed and accused me of an ethics violation. So the proper term is leaching. So just like if you heated up a plastic water bottle and the phthalates that make the plastic firmer leached into the water and you drank them, that would increase your phthalate level. So that we're all on the same page and nobody calls and accuses me of another ethics violation. That is the actual scientific process. And unless you believe the world is flat, that is what happens.
Well, and then I think of people who, okay, if implants, you know, could potentially lead to all these things that I don't really want to experience in life, especially because, like you pointed out, chronic inflammation can already lead to these symptoms without even having implants. What can women and what should women consider as a procedure rather than implants?
So there is fat transfer, and I try to do more and more education around just fat transfer because, oh my gosh, it seems like that is another thing that's gotten super confused. So, okay, I finished in 05 and I started, like I said, doing just oncologic reconstruction. And for those reconstructions where I did mastectomy reconstruction, I would do a secondary procedure, a fat transfer. And that was for helping the shaping, the contour to give a better result. And so I did probably 100 to 150 of those a year in my first 15 years. So I have a lot of experience with doing those. So when I hear some person, influencer, plastic surgeon, whatever, spewing stuff on the platforms about fat transfer, either working or not working, or how they do it, and terms like overgrafting, there's this thing that I have where overgrafting is a concept. As soon as I hear it come out of your mouth, I think you never took care of a cancer patient. Because for a cancer patient, you have to do a very specific, fundamentally sound procedure when you apply fat, because they don't have a lot of tissue left because that was mostly removed. So there's skin and there's a thin layer of fat and there may be a tiny bit of breast tissue because you can't take out every speck of breast tissue. Like, okay. Now, the concept of overgrafting means you're going to put more in there in the anticipation that some fails, and so you have more left over. So that also increases the complication rate with cyst formation, something called fat necrosis, and just firmness in general from, like, we'll say clumping or things sticking together. And so if you do that, I just find it unethical. Because if you do that to a cancer patient, what do you think they're going to feel if that doesn't work? Like they have cancer again.
Yeah.
So I don't really know. Well, I do know, because you never took care of those patients. That's obvious. And you never had a loved one or family member or friend die from cancer, because you wouldn't do or say anything that stupid if you had. It just is like a very unfortunate thing to put out, because that's not how you should be doing things. You have to be in full disclosure with patients, like, this is what's possible, here are the outcomes, and I always tell patients, I do not overgraft. I don't do that. And that's why. Yeah. The other thing I do is offer lower body weight, lower BMI fat transfers. And then this is another thing that gets completely messed up, because they'll say, oh, you'll come in the office and somebody will, you know, pinch your thigh or tummy and say, oh, you don't have enough fat. Well, I would say in 2026, we have slightly more or better metrics than that. And so I consistently use something called a DEXA scan. I prefer that. It's very consistent across the United States about availability versus something like InBody, which is more an algorithmic. And so I like that. And I try to use it to educate patients who they may have problems with body dysmorphia, and they see that they either have too much or too little. Whatever the case is, I try to just, in a very, I think, plain way, make it as simple as possible to understand what's happening. There's this amount of lean muscle mass. There's this amount of fat. It's here. And then I try to explain in a way that makes sense of instrumentation experience, how that can be utilized to help with what's going to be a difficult transformation if it's somebody who's going from a bigger implant to a smaller breast volume.
Right.
So I try to do that, knowing that everybody in the end game is concerned, whether or not they, you know, in the moment are thinking that, because they just don't feel well. And there's a lot of things going through their minds, and they'll tell me, I don't care what I look like. Well, everybody cares in the end what it's going to look like. Mm-hmm. So you can tell me that, and I appreciate it in the moment that may be the case, but in the end game, at a month or 3 months or a year or whatever, you're going to care. And it's, you know, if it's not cosmetically good enough, you know, the only way you can't get in touch with us or get help from us is if you don't try. Like, we're always going to try to help patients, and there is no perfect scenario in this, as you can imagine. So I was just talking to a patient today, and she's a very small patient, and she has kind of a moderately sized 350cc implant, which is kind of 300 to 350 is pretty common, but that's going to leave her with like a small B, and that's like, you know, a car accident happening, right? That's 100 miles an hour to zero. Mm-hmm. So can I help with that? Can I work with that patient? And she's already been told she's not a candidate for fat transfer by somebody else. So now I have to undo what she's been told, explain why I don't operate in that way, using what I consider to be it's not even a new technology. Like, it's a DEXA scan. It's been around forever. It's not new. And from an instrumentation standpoint, there's specified instruments we use for smaller, low BMI patients. Think of like a straw. If a straw has holes all the way around it, and you utilize that to take fat out, that's how you can really cause a problem in a thinner patient. But on thin patients, the holes really just need to be on one side. That side's away from the skin, so you're just taking fat out, like you're running a vacuum, right? There's only one side that works. And so you're taking the fat out, you're trying to blend everything nicely and keep it really even. And so you can do everything that I'm talking about if, in fact, one, you have a skill set, two, you have experience, three, you have the instrumentation, and four, you're going to try to help that person who's not the easiest patient to take care of, right? That's a harder group to take care of. Not everybody wants the smoke, and that's fine. But you shouldn't tell people that they can't have something just because you don't think they should, you don't want to try, you don't have the experience. Just say that you don't, or you can't, or you go see Rob. Do something. Don't tell people just because you can't do something that's not possible. That's such stupid.
So what would you say, just kind of before we wrap up here, people who are going to or have had explant surgery, what would you say are some of the most common pitfalls or things done incorrectly during their preparation, either for the procedure or in their recovery, that result in kind of suboptimal outcomes?
Yeah, I think it's just too much emphasis placed on the explant itself and not enough placed on the prep work and then the post-operative care plan. So it makes sense, right? The more you prepare, the more you get things in line, like we already mentioned. Like if you just do what I said in the beginning, you're already going to be in a much, much better situation. And then we've been fortunate to have several teachers in our program. And so they tend to plan things out. They'll tend to talk to me in like the fall of 1 year for the summer of the next for surgery. And then they'll run the program for an extended period of time. And it really gives us a nice lens to look through to see like, oh, if you do all this,
works.
It makes a lot of sense, you know, and I know it works. I've got countless of, you know, clinical examples and, you know, people are like, why haven't you published that? Well, okay. Like, what do you want me to compare it to? Right. If you don't compare it to anything, it's a very, it's a single surgeon experience. Like I published for the PCR analysis. And I often take criticism for that because they're like, oh, there's no control group. Well, the historical control is 48%, which I knew was inaccurate. So I published the largest series in the world so you could just know what it is. So you can compare it to historical controls. Now, if we publish anything moving forward about genetics or toxicity or how would we measure the inflammation, like we don't really have controls. We're dealing in kind of a world where I just had a call recently with the company that does our tox testing. I'm like, we need to be able to put something out to better explain this so the patients understand it. It would help them. And the number one toxin that we find routinely is BPA. That's in 500 tests, number one thing is BPA. Number two is, as you would expect, glyphosate. And then three is a mycotoxin and it's aflatoxin. So is any of that like earth shattering? No. But nobody has that data outside of us. Like we're the people who have the largest amount of data around the topic, but I don't have that in publication. I know the genetics. I don't have that in publication. Those would be two powerful tools to help people better understand, you know, how to approach it, because, you know, everyone wants to understand a diagnosis and what do you check? And well, it's a little bit more complicated. And you have to take a more, I think, comprehensive approach to it in order to get around the problem. It's just like dealing with chronic inflammation in general. The problem here is there's something that no matter how much work you do with a good functional doctor, chiropractor, holistic provider, naturopath, acupuncturist, nutritionist, all the things, you may not do or be able to do enough to affect the problem.
I mean, where can people go to like figure out, okay, how can I get into this program? How can I start to just, you know, start kind of this journey and potentially go into X-Plan or what that looks like for them? Where can people go and learn?
Yeah, currently the best way we've approached it is to just let people absorb content on their own. So we created a really safe environment for that in a private community called drrobcircle.com. And then on my website, drrobertwhitfield.com, we've created a answer section. So people have a lot of questions. So we created a separate answer section that just has the answer with a video. So I think we have 4,000 videos and 160 podcasts. So if you go to one of those resources, you will find it. I would say go to your favorite educational long form place to find it, but I tend to be a little censored on those platforms nowadays. So I would start on ours. And if you can't find what you need, then just ask us and we'll direct you to the right resource.
Awesome. Perfect. Yeah. If anyone's listening, we'll definitely have that linked in our show notes. And thanks for putting out such a hub of information on this. You clearly are a leading voice in the space and have the experience and done the research on the ground. And we appreciate having you come and share that with our community.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. I appreciate y'all.
It is always fascinating to talk to someone who's completely outside our scope of practice and just get a different lens. We don't know all of the things that he's talking about, right? But getting a different output and lens, someone who's actually working with people in person, is really quite fascinating. So if you heard something that you think someone else could benefit, please pass this episode along. When you share it, it gets more people listening so that we can continue to create more episodes that really help you get to know your own body.